Join me, Dr. Lauren, on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. behind the pink mic for breast cancer conversations about prevention and diagnosis to healing stories and words from expert guests. Behind the Pink Mic is proudly sponsored by Sizzle's Kitchen and Swell Endeavor. Tune in with Dr. Lauren every Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM, 1460 AM, and streaming at KCNR1460.com. Behind the Pink Mic, let's talk healing, hope, and community.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
These works of art are wonders. They're beautiful, and boy, are they so instructive. And we need them if we're going to understand ourselves and life much better, much more profoundly.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. Stephen Smith from Hillsdale's English Department. He's also your teacher for the new Hillsdale College online course, The Iliad. We go in-depth about that on today's program. Also, later on, Dr. Samuel Lair, recent graduate from the Van Andel Graduate School of Statesmanship here at Hillsdale College, and his dissertation on James Monroe we'll discuss in a bit. First, we're joined by Dr. Stephen Smith. He is Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Scott. Thank you for having me.
You're also the teacher for the new Hillsdale College online course, The Iliad, which is available now at hillsdale.edu/new course, NEWCOURSE. We have the Odyssey. Now we have the Iliad available, both of them, at that URL. So why does the Iliad still remain such an important place to begin or even continue an education in the Western literary tradition? We asked a very similar question to Dr. Whalen about the Odyssey. What about the Iliad?
I am a dyed-in-the-wool Iliad lover. I know a lot of people are crazy about the Odyssey. I've always just loved the first. And anyone out there who is enjoying the worldwide fervor over the Odyssey needs to make their way directly back to the, go back to the Iliad, baby. This where, well, not where it all starts, but where Homer starts. You know, the Iliad, it stands at the head of the epic tradition. And one of the best ways to experience the full power and beauty of poetry and what it can teach us about nature, about character, about reality is through the epic tradition. So why not begin with Rage, Goddess, Sing the Rage of Achilles, the Iliad, go to the Odyssey, and then you're off and running. Virgil's Aeneid, Dante's Divine Comedy, Paradise Lost. And if you're truly ambitious, War and Peace is lurking in the 19th century, one of the most magnificent books in the world. And a profound engagement with Homer, unless I miss my guess.
Now, before we get to a little more about the course itself and what's discussed, what story does the Iliad actually tell? People might know about Trojan War, Achilles, Helen. What are they going to discover when they actually open the book and read Homer?
They will most likely be surprised by the focus of Homer, which is one of his great gifts. Aristotle saw this unmistakably in the Poetics. This guy knows how to focus a story. I've taught the poem for many, many years, and students always wonder, why does it start so deep into the war, and why does it end before the war ends? Like, you know, it's almost like you want the Encyclopedia Britannica version of the Trojan War. Uh-huh. How did this all get started? When did they arrive? How many years have they been there? Well, what Homer does is he focuses our attention on the rage of Achilles and the will of Zeus over around a 50-day period in the 10-year war. And so it's wonderfully focused. It's intensely dramatic. Mm. It's as great as any Shakespearean tragedy you'll ever read, an unforgettable poem. And it derives much of its power and its intensity from that focus, from that choice of Homer to focus our attention like this on the Rage of Achilles and the Will of Zeus.
That is your first lecture, The Rage of Achilles, in an online course, the Iliad, hillsdale.edu/new course. That Rage of Achilles provides the structure for a lot of this. What should students understand about Achilles at the outset of the Iliad?
Well, Achilles is one of the major characters of the poem, and the poem is about, yes, his rage. It's important to understand this isn't, you know, a poem about some guy's temper tantrum or something like that, or, you know, he lost his cool in traffic. It's about a rage that's described as murderous and doomed, that cost the Achaeans, the Greeks, loss upon bitter loss, that hurled down to the house of death so many great souls, brave fighter souls, and left their bodies, you know, the feast of birds, as the opening puts it. So this is a pretty intense form of rage that overtakes this gifted warrior who is the son of a mortal man and an immortal goddess. So Achilles is a remarkable figure, one of the most unforgettable figures in literature. Don't believe anything you've heard against him. You got to get to know who this guy is, and powerful, unforgettable story about his heart, his mind, his desires, his choices, his rage. And the poem ends, suitably enough, when the rage ends. The poem actually makes tremendous and deep sense as a story, and it focuses on and one of the first things you wonder about when you open the, like, how could the rage of Achilles be the focus of an entire story? What is it about this rage? What makes it so worthy of the attention of Homer? What's going on with this guy and his soul?
The other early lectures help introduce students to Helen, Paris, Hector, the defender of Troy. What do those characters add to our understanding of the war? In particular, it's side effects on marriage, on family, on the home.
Well, the Greeks are on this lonely beach before the Scaean gates of Troy. And we get to know all the Greeks in the poem, and of course, the Trojans as well. I mean, I can't help but smile when you say those names. I mean, I feel like I've known these people for my entire working life. Helen, Paris, and Hector, and Andromache, and Priam on the Trojan side. Homer gives full humanity to them and brings out, you know, the kind of civilization level clash that's at the heart of the poem. But I think, you know, with Paris and Helen, oh my goodness, you know, this is the affair at the heart of the war. And those are two of the most unforgettable characters in the poem. In a way, they pursue a kind of glory that is different than the glory that Achilles and the others are fighting for. It's associated with beauty, with erotic love. And it's one of the more powerful forces in the poem, and disruptive forces. And then Hector is the great kind of mighty opposite of Achilles, the defender of Troy. His heart races to help his city, to save his family. And some of the greatest scenes in the poem involve Hector, including the meeting with his wife, his meetings with his brother Paris, and of course, the final duel in the poem. Spoiler alert. It's big on big, baby. It's all headed toward Achilles versus Hector for all the marbles.
You've had a few thousand years to catch up, so we don't need to give the spoiler alert. I think we're going to be okay. Dr. Stephen Smith with us. He is your teacher for the new Hillsdale online course. Hopefully you've taken the Odyssey. Now time for the Iliad. You can find it at hillsdale.edu/new course. One of the major questions running through this course is, how much responsibility belongs to the gods and how much belongs to the characters themselves? How does Homer get us thinking about fate and free choice and personal responsibility?
Well, right from that famous opening, the two subjects of the poem, if you ask me, are the rage of Achilles and the will of Zeus moving toward its end. So the poem is, in a way, a study of the will of Achilles and the will of Zeus. And so we're going to get the human side and the divine side, both at work profoundly and powerfully in the poem. Your question is a great one about personal responsibility. I'll make a bridge to the Odyssey. If you go to the first pages of the Odyssey, you will hear Zeus complain shameless the way these mortals blame the gods for everything, you know, especially when through their own reckless ways, you know, they compound the misery beyond the proper share. So Homer is all over the human tendency to locate responsibility anywhere but in the human will. I suppose we're willing to locate responsibility there when we've done something glorious.
Sure.
But when we've done something foolish, yeah, that's where the gods come in. You can blame them. For years in class with the students, you know, I've joked that if Zeus ever, you know, had a t-shirt line, it would probably read, "Don't blame me." But so he's working for his end. Achilles is working for his ends. And Homer shows us the human being really struggling with this issue of personal responsibility, Scott.
Dr. Stephen Smith is with us, your teacher for the new Hillsdale online course on the Iliad. More at hillsdale.edu/new course. We'll continue in a moment. Scott Bertram on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Premier Oil Change is celebrating 20 years of our friendly oil changes. A lot has changed in 20 years, but our commitment to fast, friendly, excellent service has remained the same. To celebrate our 20th birthday, we're offering $20 off any oil change. All you have to do is go to our website at premieroilchange.com and receive your gift. In Reading, check out our new location at 905 East Cypress. Discount also available at our Lake Boulevard, Anderson, and Palisadro locations.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier, your friendly oil change.
At Redding Heating and Air, we don't just promise fast service. We put our money where our mouth is. How does $500 in cold, hard cash sound?
Whoa, $500? Kelvin, are we serious?
Dead serious, young fella. If we don't have your new system installed within 72 hours of booking, we'll pay you $500 cash. You know, back in my day...
72 hours? Kelvin, can you even move that fast?
Anyway... That's the old-fashioned way of doing things, Chili. We respect a neighbor's time. We show up when we say we will, and we hustle until the job is done right.
It pays to use Redding Heating and Air. Restrictions apply. Visit reddingheatingair.com to schedule your 72-hour install today.
Don't wait. Let's get to work.
Redding Heating and Air. Old-fashioned service, modern-day solutions.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51.
Get ready to be a part of a Palisadro tradition. The 45th annual Honeybee Festival is buzzing into the Bishop Quinn Community Center at 21893 Old 44 Drive in Palisadro, Saturday and Sunday, September 26th and 27th. Bring the whole family for a weekend packed with fun, including a craft fair. There will also be local businesses and vendors on hand, live music, delicious food, and plenty of activities for all ages. Enjoy the NorCal Antique Tractor and Engine Parade, the always popular Bee Costume Parade, and the live Bee Beer Demonstration. Start your morning with a delicious pancake breakfast for only $10, served from 8 to 10:30 both days. The festival is Saturday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Sunday, 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. And the best part, proceeds from the festival help support Palisadro Park. So don't miss the buzz. Join the fun at the 45th annual Honeybee Festival, September 26th and 27th at Bishop Quinn Community Center in Palisadro. And special thanks to our main sponsor, Roof Savers.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Dr. Stephen Smith, Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English at Hillsdale College, and your teacher for the new Hillsdale College online course, The Iliad. Find it at hillsdale.edu/new course. Dr. Smith, Hector and Achilles are both great warriors in The Iliad, but they're very different men. As we move through the course, what might we want to notice about these two competing pictures of heroism?
Well, Achilles is the brilliant, swift runner, the greatest Greek warrior. His arms have bore the brunt of the fighting. He's won great glory through it. When his honor and his sense of justice is violated at the beginning of the poem, the whole thing is launched. So he is an intense lover of kleos and honor. He also has friendship and a regard for the Greeks as well. So he's actually a fully round character. Hector is associated with the defense of Troy. Again, that famous line, his heart races to help the fellow Trojans. So he tends to be associated with the defense of the city, with family, with his marriage and his infant son. Now, all that said, what unites the two men is just as interesting, because both men have been trained and educated and formed, you know, to intensely desire glory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what will bring them into that final conflict near the end of the poem. So it's a very rich presentation of the two great warriors, one Greek, one Trojan.
Dr. Stephen Smith with us, your teacher for the new Hillsdale course on the Iliad, hillsdale.edu/new course. You speak of glory, and Achilles is given a famous choice between a short life and everlasting glory and a long life without it. How does that choice help organize some of the big questions that we'll encounter throughout the course?
That question is at, that decision, I should say, is at the heart of the Achilles story. You know, we're in year 10 in the Iliad of the war, and he will bring up the choice that he made and is making to remain at war, pursuing glory, knowing that it will bring about his death, and the alternative, which was that long life, but with obscurity. It's funny, in the poem, Scott, he's been there for 10 years. He's made his choice,
uh-huh.
And he keeps coming back to it, almost like he could leave at any moment. Like, I can take my ships. I can get out of here. I can go back home. You know, I don't have to be here. But he stays on that beach, and he will die there. So that choice he makes is his final decision. But Homer's greatness is to show us how he grows across the Iliad and as he approaches his own death.
Yeah, so Achilles grows. He's consumed by rage at the beginning, and at the end he's learned something about self-control and virtue and mercy, too. How should we understand this transformation that takes place between book 1 and book 24?
Well, it takes 22 books or so, even 24 books, to come to the end of the rage. Achilles is tough, relentless. He becomes something like death itself close to the end of the poem. He fights a river god. He wants to strike at Apollo. He's mourning his friend. I mean, the rage reaches a really extreme point. But Homer does not leave us there. One of the big surprises in the poem is book 24, easily one of the most beautiful books of poetry in the entire world. And that finale, in which Achilles and the king of Troy come together over Hector's body, spoiler alert, is what brings about this surprising ending and what looks like a moment of growth. I mean, Priam wonders over Achilles as he decides to give the body of Hector back. And I think that what Priam is wondering over is his truly godlike quality, his virtue at that moment. And the virtue is distinct from the virtue he's displayed, you know, being a one-man death machine on the plain of Troy. It's, as you suggest, self government, self-control. He can hold himself back. He seems for a moment like a free man, capable of some other action than just raging and raging and raging and raging.
Is there one lecture or one part of a lecture even in this course that you enjoy teaching because students come away seeing the Iliad differently afterward? And you have experience having taught this countless times to our Hillsdale students.
I was thinking about that, Scott. I'm like, oh, yes, book one, book six, book nine, book 16, book 20. I'm one of those people. I love this poem, so I have many, many favorite moments. And certainly book 24 is incredible. The funeral games of Achilles' friend Patroclus are remarkable. The embassy to Achilles in book 9 is must-see TV. It's a remarkable part of the poem. But, you know, I love the moment when his mother comes to him after everything he's wanted has come to pass. You know, Achilles prays in book 1 that he be exalted and the Greeks be mowed down because he's been so dishonored. And when things have gone just as he prayed, the will of Zeus, right? But not exactly as he had expected. This is totally a meditation on be careful what you pray for.
Sure.
When you get to this moment, his mother comes, Achilles is in an agony, his friend is dead, like, all these things have happened. And his mother comes to him and says, son, why are you in tears? Why are you crying? Olympian Zeus has fulfilled your prayer just as you raised your hands in book 1. You've gotten everything you wanted. It's so painful. You know, it's wonderful. But I mean, he's going to grow from that 0 point to the ending in book 24. But not without some mega rage in between. I'm just telling you.
I already know the answer to the question, I think, but I'm still going to ask. Are you still learning and enjoying different parts of the Iliad each time you read and teach this to students?
Yes. That's a great question. With Shakespeare, with Dante, with Homer, with Genesis, with Paradise Lost, whatever, these books are so far beyond us that they continually surprise and instruct. And you can teach Homer's Iliad for 20 years and come back to it, and it is as fresh as the dawn. And you see things that you did not see before. I laugh sometimes using the books, you know, in class. I'll be rereading, prepping for class, and I'll see in my book a whole unmarked page. And now, you know, on round 20 or whatever it is, I'm like, that's the most important thing of all. Uh-huh. I didn't even have it marked.
Uh-huh.
It's that kind of work. These works of art are wonders. They're beautiful. And boy, are they so instructive and illuminating of nature, of character, of reality. They're truly, you know, at our service. And we need them if we're going to understand ourselves and life much better, much more profoundly.
Dr. Stephen Smith is Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. He's also your teacher for the new Hillsdale College online course, The Iliad, at hillsdale.edu/new-course. hillsdale.edu/newcourse. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's been my pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Up next, Samuel Lair joins us, newly minted doctor, graduate of the Van Andel School of Statesmanship here at Hillsdale College. We'll talk about the political thought and statesmanship of one James Monroe. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends, the Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771 or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons, premium offerings, unbeatable value just for you. Every drive tells a story. Morning commutes, weekend getaways, road trips that stretch for miles. That's why you need Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. At Quick and Clean Car Wash, you'll receive a detailed hand scrub pre-clean, a gentle soft cloth wash, and a personal towel dry brings out a smooth, polished shine. Fast, affordable, starting at only $12. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market Street and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Since 2019, Organic Pilates has been helping Reading build stronger bodies, not just for summer, but every season of life. Experience matters. We don't teach exercises. We teach to the body in front of us. The best way to start is with our $99 new student intro. One semi-private session, two group reformer classes, and an infrared sauna session. Visit us downtown with free parking. We're right in between curated and theory coffee. Your Pilates story starts here.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to find this show, older episodes of this program, plus tons of great Hillsdale College audio at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Look for The Larry Arnn Show, Imprimis, Hillsdale Dialogues, and more. We're joined by Dr. Samuel Lair. He's a former director of the Center for American Education at the Idaho Freedom Foundation, a recent graduate of the Van Andel School of Statesmanship here at Hillsdale College as well. Dr. Lair, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Talking today about your dissertation work at the School of Statesmanship on the political thought and statesmanship of James Monroe. You argue that Monroe was one of the most important statesmen of our founding era. What role has he played in our understanding of the founders, and why perhaps has he been a bit overlooked?
Well, my scholarship tried to tackle was the fact that he actually hasn't played a significant role in our understanding of the founding era, which is a massive, I think, injustice from historical studies. John Quincy Adams, during his eulogy of Monroe, talks about how he's the only man whose life is associated with every single major event of the founding era for a whole half century. You know, he joins the American Revolution at 17, receives a near mortal wound at the Battle of Trenton, and is involved in practically every single major political event in the founding era from then on out. You know, he's involved in the ratification of the Constitution in Virginia. He actually has a unique kind of He's one of the only founders, you know, the only president to not sign the Constitution, which makes him kind of a unique figure in that regards. But even beyond the constitutional era and the early 1790s, you know, he's ambassador to France during the George Washington administration. He's governor of Virginia during the Revolution of 1800. He's secretary of state of James Madison during the War of 1812. And then he oversees as president the Missouri Compromise. And so he's really central to all these major events. And while he's not necessarily always the number one guy on the stage, so to speak, he's always in the background. He's always there. And so I argue that if you really want to understand the founding, particularly through the eyes of great men, that Monroe is one you could do that through.
Your dissertation argues that Monroe saw the American Republic as the best regime in principle, theory, and practice. What exactly did he mean by that?
Yeah, so Monroe was deeply learned, and he read Aristotle, he read Polybius, he read Locke, Montesquieu, and one of the big things that really struck him, and you see this in some of his early writings during the constitutional ratification, is that, okay, America has a unique destiny here. He says he comments in his political treatise how it's widely regarded that American Revolution is the most important event in human history. And because it's the first regime to be predicated on the fundamental truth of natural equality. But it's also, in a lot of ways, he viewed America as redeeming the cause of self-government for the world and for the West. But when he looks back, he thinks about how Athens failed, Sparta failed, Rome failed, right? That self-governments have also been often been fickle. And so, you know, America is the best regime for Monroe because it is the first regime predicated on natural equality. But it's also the best regime in practice, he believes, because it solved some of these fundamental issues regarding faction and stability that he believes ate at the core of the old republics. And it did that through our constitutional order, which is quite fascinating for Monroe because, as I mentioned, he voted against the ratification of the Constitution originally.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time he leaves the presidency and returns to the plow, so to speak, he's reflecting on America and the things that it overcame. And he firmly believes that lesser regimes, like the French Republic, would have succumbed to the sort of pressures that America dealt with during the founding. He equates that to the strength of our constitutional order and the wisdom of the Constitution itself. And so America is a great balance between theory and practice for Monroe. It's the best regime in principle because it's predicated on natural equality, but it's also the best regime in practice because it's created a stable constitutional order that allows liberty to thrive.
Talking with Dr. Samuel Lair, his dissertation on the political thought and statesmanship of James Monroe. You describe Monroe as believing that human beings are naturally political. How did that help shape his view of citizenship and of self-government?
Yeah, so Monroe read Aristotle, and Aristotle is the one that kind of begins this notion of man as a political animal. Monroe believes the same thing. He talks about in his political treatise how men are essentially controlled by moral causes. He says that they're effectually creatures of circumstances influenced by the times within which they live. And that's important for Monroe because it speaks to the trueness of Republican government, right? Man's not meant merely to be ruled, right, without also being ruled in turn, right? So, yes, he is. And this goes to actually the central thesis of his book. He describes it, or the title of his book is The People, the Sovereigns, right? And that's because the people hold the sovereignty in the American regime. He talks about how sovereignty in the American context is a kind of dual character, right? You're both the ruler of the American regime as a citizen because sovereignty flows from you, but you're also obeying the laws, the Constitution of the American Republic itself. And so he viewed man's political nature as perfectly in accordance with what the founders are trying to create when they established the Constitution. But he also viewed it as essentially tied to other facets of American institutions, namely education. He's one of the largest proponents of education in the American founding, and this notion of man as a political animal deeply informed his views on education. It's why he promoted widely public education is because he believed that you had to take that kernel, right, that base nature that man has, and try to help see it fulfilled so that way he could truly become a self-governing citizen of a republic.
Dr. Samuel Lair with us talking about the political thought and statesmanship of James Monroe. One of the themes in your dissertation is Monroe's concern with preserving the republic. What threats to the republic worried him the most?
In his political treatise, Monroe says that there's two threats that threaten the preservation of the republic: consolidation and disunion. And he viewed both of these through the lens in which he saw them as a political operator, in addition to a wannabe political theorist, so to speak. During the 1790s, you know, he's one of the major political figures in the Democratic Republican Party, alongside Jefferson and alongside Madison. And he viewed the Federalists of his time, although he walks this back eventually, as moving the republic towards a consolidated monarchy, right? So there's this notion that we're going to erode the constitutional order predicated on federalism, and that we're all going to centralize power into the executive, right? So the state powers will be delegated to the federal government, and then eventually Congress's powers will be delegated into the executive, and you're going to have a monarchy. And this is something that he learned also through his study of the ancient republics. He noticed that both Athens and Rome had a tendency to centralize power and strong men when they were threatened. But Monroe also, as he came along, started to realize, particularly during the War of 1812, that America was also threatened by a different problem, and that's what ultimately the Union succumbed to during the Civil War, which was disunion. And he first encountered this during the Hartford Convention near the end of the War of 1812, where several Federalist strongholds in Massachusetts and Connecticut and elsewhere kind of flirted with the idea of secession. But then it really hit him full bore during the Missouri crisis. And that's when he fully started to understand that, like, oh, there's something else here that we have to be aware of. And so his presidency in a lot of ways can be understood as trying to tamp down these two competing tendencies in the American Republic. One towards consolidation, which he tried to do through proper Republican management, so to speak, but also through unity, right? Trying to unify the American people around our common sentiments rooted in the Declaration of Independence to prevent us from tearing apart in a way that eventually did during the Civil War.
That's Dr. Samuel Lair, who wrote his dissertation on James Monroe. We'll continue talking in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The only real estate agent I trust right here in Redding and Shasta County is Josh Barker with Josh Barker Real Estate. Now, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Now, if someone hasn't sold a home in a long time, well, what surprises them the most about the process today?
You know, Sean, that's actually a really good question. And I think what I would say is that it's just how agents are compensated for their services. In the past, you negotiated a fee and you didn't have a chance to renegotiate when the offer came in. Now, the way that it works is that an agent lists the property and you only cover the listing agent portion up front. And then later, when you get an offer on your property, that's when you negotiate the buyer portion of a fee. And so in reality, our sellers are saving thousands of dollars with good negotiation.
All right, thanks for keeping us up to date.
Talk to the only agent in town I recommend. Go online to reddinghomes.com. That's Redding, R-E-D-D-I-N-G, homes.com, or just Google Josh Barker.
Your home deserves to look its absolute best. At Divine Shine, we provide professional window cleaning, pressure washing, soft washing, and complete exterior cleaning services for homes and businesses. From crystal clear windows to spotless driveways and beautifully refreshed home exteriors, our experienced team delivers results you'll notice immediately. Schedule your free estimate today by calling 530-900-3156. Again, that's 530-900-3156. Divine Shine, professional exterior cleaning you can count on.
The Ramsey Show.
You actually can help people, and you don't help them by giving them a government program. You help them by showing them the way out. People love me enough to put their arm around me and show me a different way. I didn't figure it all out in my own head. So there's a power to hope. That's not some kind of false panacea positive thinking way. It works. You can't positive think your way into everything, but you can't negative think your way into anything.
Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
Guys, if you think antique stores aren't your thing, well, you've never been to Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 273 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson. Sure, you'll find great furniture and home decor, but that's just the beginning. Check out fishing gear, hunting apparel and supplies, military and war memorabilia, beer steins, sports collectibles, jerseys, vintage photographs, some signed, and collectible trading cards. Whether you're a lifelong collector or just looking for something unique for your man cave, you'll find treasures around every corner. Browse shelves of classic DVDs, VHS movies, CDs, and books. Discover quality copper cookware that's built to last. Or pick up a few favorites from the Amish food section featuring jams and popcorn, even soaps and lotions. Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectible. Open Monday from 10 to 6, Thursday through Saturday 10 to 6, and Sunday from noon to 5. Closed Tuesday and Wednesday. Memory Lane Antiques Vintage and Collectibles at 1773 Highway 23 in the Shasta Gateway Center in Anderson.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Samuel Lair is with us. He is a recent graduate of the Van Andel School of Statesmanship here at Hillsdale College. His dissertation on James Monroe. Dr. Lair, something you write about is how Monroe applied these principles to issues like slavery and the American Indians. How did he reconcile those issues with some of the ideals found in the Declaration?
Monroe on the Indian question, so to speak, is particularly interesting because, you know, that's a very controversial topic, right? It's hard to look back on and view nuance in the Indian removal policies of Jackson. But when you read Monroe and you read the founders generally, you actually start to realize that the founders weren't these bigots, you know, rubbing their hands together, trying to think about how they could steal land from the Native Americans. Monroe actually had a profound respect for Native American culture. He calls them free and high-minded in his political treatise. And he actually views Native American society and its kind of proto-Republican institutions as a fundamental proof of the Republican thesis that man is by nature free and equal. But he also, you know, as a Lockean, so to speak, believes fundamentally in this notion that property belongs to the rational and industrious. When Jackson seizes Florida, he talks about in one of his addresses that, or it's actually a letter to Madison, that land must be managed in such a way that it provides the greatest benefit to the greatest number, right? So that we can essentially follow the first commandment to be fruitful and multiply. And so Monroe's trying to wrestle with these two things, right? Essentially, the natural rights of the Native Americans, along with his deep respect for their culture, but also this other notion that, so to speak, that, well, we have this Lockean mandate in order to develop this, you know, unproductive land in the American West. And the way he approaches it is, you know, actually much more nuanced than the Jackson administration eventually did. He was an early supporter, so-called Indian removal, but he viewed it as a more humane policy. He didn't view it as a greedy policy. He actually believed fundamentally that this was the best way to secure Native Americans in their way of life in a lot of many ways, but also their existence. You read his writings and he worries deeply about the influence civilization has on, you know, kind of pre-civilized peoples, right? They're not used to the vices and the luxuries of alcohol and jewelry and all these sort of things. And he thinks it could be corrupting to people who are unprepared for it in the same way he thinks it's corrupted Europe. Mm. And so his administration, along with John C. Calhoun, was his Secretary of War, kind of developed the early plan for Indian removal based on this notion that we're going to provide equal and just terms to the Native Americans. We're going to give them fair compensation for their land in the West, and then we're going to relocate them west of the of the Mississippi. And in turn, we're going to introduce them to agriculture. We're going to introduce them to private property. We're going to develop schools for them. We're going to develop institutions of government so that way they can understand how Republican government is supposed to work. And actually, his ultimate vision was that he hoped that this so proto-Indian state he was creating would eventually become part of the Union.
Talking with Dr. Samuel Lair about his dissertation work on the political thought and statesmanship of James Monroe. Monroe was deeply skeptical of political parties. Why did parties pose a danger to constitutional government? And why did he believe that a healthy republic would be just fine without them?
Monroe's understanding of political parties was deeply influenced by the ancient political writers on the subject of faction. Aristotle, Polybius, and others. And fundamentally, he viewed political parties as an extension of the old mixed regime, so to speak. The constitutional order promoted by Aristotle and Polybius and Cicero and others that talked about how we need to balance the interests of the few, the many, and the one, which you kind of see in the Roman Republic, which you saw at that time contemporaneously with Monroe and the Great Britain. And he viewed political parties as essentially engines of faction in that sense, right? If we promote political parties, we're always going to be pitting a party for the few against the party of the many, which is just going to undermine the civil harmony accord of America's republic. And I think one of the most fascinating parts of his presidency is his efforts to suppress this. His national tours, he's actually the first president to tour the United States, and there's this really striking image during it when he enters Boston during the 4th of July, and he goes to Boston Commons, and this is a time where, you know, Massachusetts is just about to secede, or it was thinking about seceding during the War of 1812. It's the Federalist stronghold. It didn't vote for him, but he viewed this as an opportunity for unity. And when he enters into Boston Commons, there's a few hundred school children, and all the boys, I believe, are in red roses and all the girls are in white roses. And for people who know their history of the War of the Roses, the red and the white rose are the Tudor rose. It's the rose of unity that the Tudor household developed is to show that the British kingdom was united. And that was a symbol from the Federalist to Monroe saying that the old distinctions between Federalist and Republican are no more. We need to unify under this common banner of Americans the same way you did in 1776. Monroe saw in that brief instant during the Era of Good Feelings that actually some unity is possible, right? We can do this. We're the greatest nation on earth, right? We don't need to resort to these old modes and structures of the ancient republics to depend on. The quote he uses in his treatise is that we don't always have to be threatened by the bayonet, right, in order for us to work together, mm-hmm. right? Man is by nature, he thinks, kind of altruistic and political, right, in the sense that we want to work together. We're inclined to be in communities. And he truly believed that by although it's romantic, you know, it's still nice, which is that if we firmly adhere to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, if we firmly try to live out the spirit of 1776, that we can kind of overcome, so to speak, some of the worst parts of our nature.
So if we look at Monroe, we know he emphasizes civic virtue, public education, institutions that prepare citizens for self-government. What lessons can we perhaps take from that for modern America?
I think the greatest lesson you can take from Monroe is on his view of civic virtue and public education. Right now, our education system is in very much a bad way, with few exceptions. And Monroe essentially argued for what we would call today patriotic education, education which is primarily directed towards the formation of a citizen capable of self-government. And that kind of cuts against many of the modes and orders that currently go through most education systems in this country. The easiest one, you know, even beyond some of the controversial topics regarding DEI, you know, just on the base level of many states still view public education or education generally as workforce development, mm-hmm. right? That the primary goal for education is to get you a job.
Mm-hmm.
Monroe would recognize that as partly true, but you have to remember what makes public education actually just, right? It's not that you're kind of centrally planning the economy. It's that we're all in this together. And that when you go to the ballot box, your vote has a fundamental and serious impact on the rights of other citizens. And so we all have this shared common interest in ensuring that everyone has the basic virtue necessary for self-government. And I think really, if we looked at how Monroe and frankly the other founding fathers as well talked about education, it provides a really timeless model, right? We're always worried about 21st century education. How do we deal with education in the advent of AI and all these things? Where it's, no, we go back to how the founders understood it, right? We are a republic. Education, as Aristotle recognized, has to be directed towards the former regime. And so our first and primary obligation should be preparing citizens for this great duty that they have to be citizens of our constitutional order. And I think that's probably one of the greatest lessons that Monroe has for us today.
Dr. Samuel Lair is former director of the Center for American Education at Idaho Freedom Foundation, also a recent graduate at the Van Andel School of Statesmanship here at Hillsdale College, and his dissertation work on the political thought and statesmanship of James Monroe. Dr. Lair, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. It was all mine.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Stephen Smith, your teacher, for the new Hillsdale College online course, The Iliad, at hillsdale.edu/new-course. And Dr. Samuel Lair, his dissertation on James Monroe. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Could someone you know use a little extra comfort right now? Alliance Heating and Air is team up with Lennox to bring Feel the Love to our community. A special program providing free heating and cooling systems to homeowners in need. A simple nomination can make a big difference. Nominate today at homecomfort.org or call 2212-642 Alliance Heating and Air. Because everybody calls us 2212-642.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Hello, my name is Lindsay Myers. I'm the president and CEO of Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Thank you to Redding Rancheria for all of their support and partnership over the years.
Hi, I'm Heather Kellenhofer, president of NorCal Breast Cancer Connection, continuing the legacy of NorCal Think Pink. We would like to express our sincere gratitude to Redding Rancheria for all the support over the years.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
The sea, blue, vast, ever in motion. You remember how you felt the sky and that breeze carrying the scent of the high seas. That sense of calm, tranquility, aware of your small place atop that deep blue ocean. Deep Blue by Casa Carrillo. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So, what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.